Sam, I have a list of what I'm calling dumb ideas that made $1 million. These are obscure lists that really only people like you and me would ever even keep. But I have a list of dumb ideas that actually worked.
I feel like I could rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel.
I say dumb, not because I think they're dumb. I actually think they're genius, because I think being clever and doing simple things is actually a form of genius. But I think other people would call these dumb ideas. So I want to run through them with you, and I want you to give me your reaction to each one.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, first one came up. I was watching the NFL playoffs, which were on this weekend. I don't know if you've paid any attention, but like the Chicago Bears, who have sucked for a long time, are in the playoffs, and Chicago has this rival, the Green Bay Packers. And the Packers have been great for a long time, and the Bears have sucked for a very long time. And so it's like kind of a rivalry just by like location, but they're not really like close rivals. And so I'm watching the game and I look, and in the crowd, I just see a ton of people wearing, like, I don't know how much you know about football, but do you know what the Packers fans wear on their head?
Yeah, cheese heads.
Cheese heads. So what do the Bears fans wear?
I don't know. Helmets? I don't know.
Cheese graters. And so I see all these fans wearing this like silver cheese grater hat. And I'm like, oh, that's clever. Like, we're about to shred the Green Bay Packers. We're going to shred the cheese heads. And I'm like, this is really smart. So I'm starting to look at, what's the story behind this? And the story behind this is kind of crazy. So if you go to foampartyhats.com, this business started in 2017. So Grace Rojas and her son, Manuel Rojas, they create this thing. And they had actually for like, you know, 15 years, they had just for fun been making like fun party hats. Like, I think for their own daughter's like party, they made fun party hats for all the guests. People loved it. And they kind of gave it up. And then they moved. And then they like started again. And they're like, we're going to make these foam hats for special events, parties, occasions, and sports. And so they've been kind of like trucking along. They got on Shark Tank and they gave up 25% of their company for $100,000, right? So like, you know,
they did this
deal with Mark Cuban. Yeah. And, you know, birthdays, wedding, corporate events. They had all these like novelty hats. And then came the boom. So this grater head thing has just taken off and become this like viral frenzy. So like basically the Bears, they have this coach. I don't know if you've seen this guy, Ben Johnson. He's kind of got like, if Sam Parr was into football energy a little bit. He's this basically this young coach who's supposed to be really, really smart. He's super like ripped. So every time in the post game, he'll like in the locker room, he just like rips off his shirt, which like most of the old like 70-year-old coaches would never do. And he gets his team like really fired up. But he gives the game ball to this guy who comes out. And I don't know if you can see this, but he's getting this wide receiver, DJ Moore. He's wearing the hat. And so he's wearing this. This guy, DJ Moore, and he starts dancing. The team starts chanting, go DJ, go DJ. There's a Lil Wayne song. He starts dancing. This clip goes viral, right? This has 2.2 million views. And suddenly, these hats are flying off the shelves. And they do like 10,000 orders in a week, which is like $500,000 in a week. They have this huge wait list now, this huge backlog, because they make these by hand, apparently. And this idea of like team-specific novelty merch. Because like if like sports fans, like when I went to that Warriors game, I walked out, I bought my son a jersey, a little ball, but it's like all so like vanilla. It's all cookie cutters, like the same things over and over again. But with social media, the teams now have little like trends, little meme moments. And if you could fast follow those meme moments and create stuff that's going to like kind of make somebody laugh or be worth sharing on social media, you can actually get a lot of spread. And so that's what this company's been doing with these hats and going viral. So they've built like basically a $1 million plus business now off of these like novelty foam hats. Isn't that wild?
They do a really good job of making me into the story. Like it looks like it's a Hispanic like family, and looks like the son is kind of the CEO and the mom is like one who is the brains and kind of came up with the idea and originally made it.
Yeah.
It looks pretty awesome.
Yeah, but I think if somebody takes this idea, there was another company, like a t-shirt company, I can't remember the name, but they were doing this for sports teams where they realized like the drop shipping infrastructure has become so good that if anything happens in the game like last night, within an hour after the game, they can have the store up for that product, for that slogan, for that thing. Linsanity happens in New York, and then they go, they have like the Linsanity like line ready to go. And so I forgot what the name of this company is, but they're basically like rapidly, like much faster, like orders of magnitude faster than the typical like merch industry, creating team specific, moment specific merch. And I just think that's like a, it's not the best business, not a business I would want to be in, but it is like a simple man's business. Like anybody can understand what they're doing and be able to like try to replicate that. And if you niche down, even all the way, forget t-shirts, like to giant oversized foam hats. It's like there's a $1 million business sitting in oversized foam hats, which is pretty wild. All right, ready for the next one?
Yeah, that was a quotable last line. There's a $1 million business sitting in an oversized foam hat. All right, so a lot of people watch and listen to this show because they want to hear us just tell them exactly what to do when it comes to starting or growing a business. And really, a lot of people who are listening, they have a full-time job and they want to start something on the side, a side hustle. Now, a lot of people message Sean and I and they say, all right, I want to start something on the side. Is this a good idea? Is that a good idea? And again, what they're really just saying is, just give me the ideas. Well, my friends, you're in luck. So my old company, The Hustle, they put together 100 different side hustle ideas, and they have appropriately called it the Side Hustle Idea Database. It's a list of 100 pretty good ideas, frankly. I went through them. They're awesome. And it gives you how to start them, how to grow them, things like that. It gives you a little bit of inspiration. So check it out. It's called the Side Hustle Idea Database. It's in the description below. You'll see the link. Click it. Check it out. Let me know in the comments what you think.
All right. Here's the next one. So as you know, a long time ago, I was running a business called birthdayalarm.com. This was a business started by Michael and Zochi Birch. It had been going for 20 plus years, printing, you know, millions of dollars a year. It was one of the earliest viral businesses ever. So I think Birthday Alarm has had like 50 million plus members with zero marketing spend because Michael was one of the pioneers of viral marketing. And so he understood how to get this business to grow virally.
How much revenue has this done over the course? It's 20 years. It's 20 years old.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. It's probably 25 years old now.
And so, has this done like 100 million over 25 years?
Probably not 100. Probably like over 50. So maybe 75 million is my guess.
Wow. So
just hyper profitably, by the way. Like that's like that's not just revenue is profit for a business like this.
So 3 million every year for 25 years ish.
Not exactly, but yeah, average. Let's say average 2 to 3.
Okay, wow, amazing.
Because the business model is very simple. So it's reminders for your friends and family's birthdays. Fantastic. And then I was like, but the reminders are free. So you make the money when people pay to send a card. And I remember when we were trying to like grow the business or revitalize the business, I was brainstorming ideas with him. And I was like, you know, I try not to be too smart. So I always just like, what's already working or has worked in the past or is working for other people? And so that was my first question. Before I tell you any of my bad ideas, tell me about some things that are already proven to work. And he goes, you know, at the beginning, these guys approached us with this goofy idea that I thought was a total scam. He's like, but I think they've actually made even more money than we did without the 50 million members. And I go, what is it? He goes, it's this thing called the International Star Registry.
Oh my gosh, I have heard of this.
And so he goes, they let you, for like a special occasion for your friend, or, you know, friend's birthday or whatever, you can gift them their name on a star. You can name a star in the universe after your friend. It'll show you the star. It'll tell you the location of it. And for the low price of $25, that star is yours. Technically, not technically yours at all. Not owned, not even officially named, just named in our book that we're going to keep in our office. And so these guys have been printing millions of dollars for also 20 plus years, just naming stars after people. And this got popular. It was like, it's been referenced in movies. It was like in A Walk to Remember. They like, someone is dying. They name a star after her. Like, it's this emotional, sentimental thing. And I love it because it's a pure play marketing product. There is no product. Like, you don't get to have the star. They don't, you know, there's nothing changes hands. It's literally not even officially naming the star after them. It's literally just, we are going to write it down in our book. Permanently. It's like something I would trick my kids with.
What's really funny is if you Google Star Registry, you could see they're buying ads against each other. There's like dozens of these companies,
like seven of them.
Which begs the question, like, you know, like whose book is like the more permanent book? But is this the one that was founded in 1979?
Yeah, 1979, when like kind of space was hot and the moon and all that. So You get a certificate, you get a map of where the thing is, and you get to have that forever in their book. And so the funny thing is, like, they are like kind of the the details of this, which I think are like pretty funny. You know, think about it from a marketing point of view. How do you legitimize this, you know, frankly, illegitimate thing? And what they did was they basically like, they made their book so official. They're like, it's placed in the Library of Congress. And we store the official book in a Swiss vault, in a Swiss bank, in a vault. And you're right, like just leveraging like prestige and—
Like, are any of those things impressive? Like, how do you get a book into the library? Like,
you probably donate a copy.
Like, one of my favorite copywriters, Joe Sugarman, wrote this famous ad for Casio watches. And he asked the guys who made the watch, he was like, explain to me how this watch is made. And they say, well, we use a quartz movement and then we use this type of aluminum. And he goes, hold on, did you say quartz movement? And they go, yeah, it's like a movement that every $10 watch uses. He's like, but tell me more about quartz. And he finds out what quartz means. And then he's like, tell me about the steel. He's like, yeah, or this metal. He's like, oh, it's just aluminum. It's just like, you know, we use it. This pen company uses it. Hell, even like NASA uses it. Did you just say space grade aluminum? And so if you read this old ad for the Casio watch, he was like, made with the same aluminum that's space grade, or is like, it's space grade aluminum. It is called that because NASA uses it on their rocket ships to make it so strong with the
right.
with the quartz movement, which is the most precise movement. It's the same thing that Rolex uses, or like something like that. And so he like took like a truth and made it sound a lot cooler than it is, sort of like in a Swiss bank account.
He took a fact and he made it value.
Yeah.
By the way, I think this is the what's that thing called, the Rorschach test or whatever, the ink blot, and you're like, is this a bunny rabbit or a serial killer, right? Like, to me, that's what you just described is the thing for this podcast. It's like if there was like a speakeasy and you had to come in and like we had to decide who gets in and who gets out, I'd tell this Sugarman story and I'd be like, do you find that amazing or repulsive? They're like, well, that's bullshit. And you're like, cool, you should just head to the next bar. And if they're like, that's amazing, how do I do that? They're like, come on in, welcome to MFM.
That's pretty good. How long, did you ever look up who owned this company? Do they have like some crazy story like Michael Birch?
Yeah, so it was owned by this Canadian advertising executive, but only for like a year. I think he like passed away 2 years later. And then this mom of 12, who gifted a star to her husband, loved it, finds out that like the business is like, you know, for sale. She buys it and then they've grown it as a family business. Now her son is the operator of it or something like that. So this mom of 12 did it, which by the way, if you're a mom of 12, you're hired. You're capable of doing anything if you can be a mother of 12. Like, I don't know what Navy SEAL training is like, but it does not compare to being a mother of 12.
Dude, on their it's called starregistry.com, on their about us page, they explain how they're democratizing the cosmos and all this stuff. And then they have a line that says, do not be fooled by the imposters. And it's this...
Those other guys.
It's this big paragraph that says, in the vast experience of celestial naming, and there are also imposters seeking to capitalize on the allure of the stars. Numerous companies have attempted to copy us, and they go on to say why they're the more official one.
Right.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, snake oil salesman says other guys' oil is terrible for you.
Yeah.
Did I tell you how he came up with this idea?
No.
Michael had they were both, I think, working at an insurance company. And he's like, we were making really good money because he's like, computers were new and like not many people knew how to do programming for computers. The internet was new. Insurance companies needed somebody who could do like database programming or whatever. So he's doing that. I think he told me they were making like a really good salary, like maybe like 200 grand a year, maybe combined, maybe the two of them. I don't know. They were doing well. So the internet boom starts kind of like 1998, 1999. And he's like, what am I doing sitting here at an insurance company? I got to be a part of this, which I'm sure today many people feel that way about AI and you know, the way the robotics and the way the world is going. So he said his friend sends him a site, a link to you know, some Friendster or something like that. He's like, wow, this is incredible. I gotta get in there. I gotta start doing things. And so he decides, I'm gonna create a self-updating address book. So like, you know, today, this is still an unsolved problem, by the way. Sam, you move. I don't have your new address. I have to keep asking you for your address. I don't know when you move. So he had this idea. Well, the way it should work is when Sam moves, he changes his address once and it changes automatically. And anybody who he's already accepted, like to have his address, like it changes for everybody. a great idea. Still a great idea. This is an idea that he had. Many, like Sean Parker, you know, who's famous from The Social Network and, you know, Facebook, he tried to start a company doing this too. Like a bunch of smart people have been like, we're going to solve this problem. It just turns out people don't really care enough to do it. But he's building this thing. It's called Lemon Link. He's like, you know, the best thing that ever happened was, he's like, we had no money. So he's like, I'm the programmer. I'm the designer. I'm the product manager. I'm customer service. I'm the janitor. I'm everything, right? Because there's nobody else. And he told his wife when he quit his job, he's like, give me 3 months to try this computer thing and like this internet thing. And like, if it doesn't work in 3 months, I promise, like, we'll go back to having a job. Because I think they were like pregnant with their second or third kid. And so it was like, you know, not super like stable time to just quit your job. Well, 2 years goes by and he's like, I'm so close. I've just keep, I need another 3 months. Let me keep going. So he's still trying. He's doing customer service and LemonLink is not growing. And he's like, the only thing I'm getting in customer service is basically like, shut down my account. I don't need this. Or, hey, thanks for that birthday reminder. You saved my butt, you know? Because he's like, I added this one feature in addition to the address thing. Like, oh, by the way, like save their birthday too. And I'll tell you when it's their birthday. That's a good feature. And he's like, I kept seeing that. And this was pre-Facebook. So people didn't have an easy online way to know when their friend's birthday was. And so he realized, oh, this is a thing. And that was because he was doing customer service and because he finally faced reality, which is like, nobody wants my idea, but they do seem to want this. Then, you know, overnight he creates birthdayalarm.com. And like within a couple of weeks, he gets like 10,000 members. And he's like, oh my God. He's like, this was, because he figured out a viral loop. And he's like, to this day, you know, that was still the best feeling. But even before we made any money, getting to 10,000 members, like that was crazy.
It's pretty crazy he had the audacity to stop working on that and work on Bebo. Like most everyone else would say, all right, birthday alarm. How do we make anniversary alarm? How do we do this? How do we do that?
It's working and it starts making a little bit of money. Not much, but a little bit of money. And his friend Morgan sends him a link to Friendster at the time. And he's like, oh, of course. People are going to want to like, this internet thing, it's not just looking up information. They're going to want to like talk to their friends and post photos about each other, you know, like stuff like that. Like that makes total sense. So he created a Friendster like product. It goes viral again because he really understands virality, but he's losing money because the more members that sign up, the more his bandwidth costs. And at the time, social networks didn't have any way of making money. Like today, Facebook is known for like Facebook ads. There was no ads at the time. And so there was no ad network. Nobody had ever done that before. Nobody knew how to make money off of those things. So he went to a meetup and he sold the business to James Courier for like $2 million. And he was like, and he went and worked for them for a year. And then kind of like as social networking was maturing, he's seeing what MySpace is doing. He's like, oh, okay, I think I know what I should be doing. I learned even more about virality here. Now I'm going to go start Bebo. Then he started Bebo. And that was the one that took off.
And that was like in 2 or 3 years, he grew it from nothing to like an $800 million exit, right?
I'm not sure how many years. Yeah, 3-4 years probably.
Like very short.
Yeah.
What a baller. Damn. And now he's just the sole proprietor of littlebirthdayalarm.com.
Just a mom and pop shop.
Yeah, just trying to make ends meet.
Today's episode is brought to you by HubSpot. Did you know that most businesses only use 20% of their data? That's like reading a book, but then tearing out 4/5 of the pages. Point is, you miss a lot. And unless you're using HubSpot, the customer platform that gives you access to the data you need to grow your business, the insights that are trapped in emails, call logs, transcripts, all that unstructured data makes all the difference. Because when you know more, you grow more. And so if you want to read the whole book instead of just reading part of it, visit HubSpot.com. I have one more very dumb idea that I admire for its simplicity. So you probably are a subscriber to this YouTube channel. Can you just type in 10-hour fireplace?
Of course. I mean, everyone is, aren't they?
So there, what you will see, describe what you see when you type in 10-hour fireplace and then click their YouTube channel.
They have done a very good job of naming it. So I see, oh my God, I didn't realize it was that big. Okay. Holy moly. Okay, so obviously it's what you guys expect. It's a 10-hour video of a fireplace with 157 million views.
Exactly. There's how many videos on this channel, Sam?
So they posted this 10 years ago, and shockingly, they have 120,000 subscribers, and there is one video. And it's so funny. There's like points in the video that, you know how when you scroll over YouTube, there's points where it spikes? Like, where the viewers, I'm like, why
or
is
the viewers
this
are just loving it?
Yeah, like, why is it?
Oh, so let's look at the most replayed section. Like,
oh, they don't even add logs. They don't even add logs to the fire. So it must be like a 30-second loop just done over and over and over again. Like, there's parts where it spikes. You see this the part at 5 hours and 55 minutes?
Thrilling. Everybody knows about that part.
Oh, the top comment, bro's a millionaire.
Bro is a millionaire because this guy is a. This channel was started by one person in Romania. It's a channel with one video. So this guy just hit it and quit it. This is the one hit wonder.
Did you just
of
say
the business
hit it
world?
And quit.
He posted one video of a 30-second loop of a fireplace, or I don't know if it's a 30-second loop, but a 10-hour video of a fireplace crackling. And this guy made $1 million in Romania. And did he try to follow it up with another video and then turn it into an empire and then create? No, he just put the video up and let it run, baby. I admire this. I admire the restraint maybe more than I admire the ingenuity.
Dude, have you noticed on YouTube what's been going on with these types of things? So I don't know. I guess we can call it an ambient channel. Let's call it these. Let's categorize them as ambient channels. I like I love ambient channels. I listen to like the weird
white
music.
Noise?
Yeah, it started as white noise. There's this company called Brain FM. Do you know Brain FM?
Yeah.
I love Brain FM. So they make some of my favorite noise. just great noise. I was a paying subscriber to Brain FM years ago.
Oh my God.
So I love Brain FM. But then I started going down the rat hole of like other music. So there's like, they call it is it like lo-fi Mac Miller? It's basically just Mac Miller.
Lo-fi.
For some reason, I don't know how I got to, I like Mac Miller, but not enough that I would think he'd start popping up on my channel. So it's tons of like lo-fi Mac Miller, which I love. But what I've noticed is that there's basically like a quadrant or like a huge graph where it's like, let's do old money, let's do 1980s, let's do this. And then it's like, now select country. So for example, I keep getting targeted with old money Brazil or 1980s finance. Or like it's like, and they create the best AI thumbnail. So type in old money Brazil music.
Old money Brazil music.
Trust me, it's so strange.
All right. I see this gentleman in this nice suit with a cigar and old money Brazil, elegant bossa nova, timeless luxury instrumental playlist, 74,000 views.
I get targeted with so many of these. There was another one where it was like...
You get targeted or you select? You beg for them?
You make the algorithm. So yeah, like if I see that image, it might get a
first
click.
First we shape our algorithm, then our algorithm shapes us. The old Winston Churchill.
But then there was like, there's even crazier ones where it's like greedy American Revolution. Like I don't like locked in American Revolution or something like that. Like it's like... It's crazy how like specific they get, but they basically just take like, like.
You're joking. This is real. 90 minutes of American War revolutionary music, Liberty song playlist.
And they like, do you see like a good one?
Oh, define good, bro. I'm never gonna click any of these.
Like the thumbnails are so funny. Like, I'll have to find a different one, but the thumbnail, I tweeted out the other day, I was like, the thumbnail gods have been smiling on me. And it's like an American Revolution, like music, but the best thumbnail ever. And I keep getting targeted over and over and over again. These guys must be doing well. You've never seen these?
Well, I've seen just a normal lo-fi, so like Lo-Fi Girl, for example. Lo-Fi Girl, I think, is probably the biggest channel in this category. 15 million subscribers, 2.5 billion views on the channel, making about $100,000 a month on this channel right now. And that's one channel. Right now, she's live. There's 30,000 people just listening to this right now while we're recording this.
It's the best. So look at the.
Why don't we just do this?
It sounds awesome.
Why are we talking?
Look at the thumbnail that I sent to you.
Oh, this is incredible. What is this?
Explain what you see.
I mean, I don't even have a word for this. It looks like, you know, like that, what's the painting at the top of the Sistine Chapel where like the naked man's reaching out to like God and their fingers are about to touch? It looks like that guy, but he's got his dukes up like he's about to fight and he's like a hairless naked man with like half a mullet and it just says classical music that goes hard.
Yeah, or I'll see them where it looks like paintings like that and they're giving like the shocker sign. And so I just get like so many of these. And I think it just, there's like this weird underground world. There's that underground world and there's the underground world of the comments. So if you look at MFM's comments, people can't see this, but on the back end, we've tried to ban them where it's like, I can't believe no one has been blessed. Why hasn't anyone blessed me before? Like they've just blessed me after I read this book called like, you know, Millionaires Are Us. Like, or it'll be like, I totally agree with this video. And it's so funny that this video that you guys are making these points, because I read about this exact thing in the Millionaires Are Us book by this person who's a total saint.
Dude, this is, those guys are like the bane of my existence, by the way.
Same,
like,
it's the worst.
I just sit there and like manually try to get rid of them. Have you seen this guy, Yang Mun on Instagram? It's like an AI monk. And he's got this like healing guide. He's got
into it.
He's got like 1 to 2 million followers, and it's a monk who's just doing like talking head advice videos. And then he sells a healing guide. And again, it's like, you know, it's a guy who's like, you know, it's a kid who's 17 with like the broccoli haircut who had just moved to Miami, and he's in a house with seven other guys, and they're all creating these accounts that are like,
dude,
there's one of just
it's
elderly.
Sold on Whoop. You know, what's that thing called? WAP or Whoop, where you buy like financial newsletters. Yeah. If you go to Yang Mun's link tree, you click off.
Because that's what a monk would do, right?
He would be on WAP.
The ebook, Time to Heal, Young Man.
And then it's like things you might love. And then it's like newsletters that it's like 10x your wealth with this stock tip.
Yeah, but people are doing this. They're doing this with fake grandparents. So they have like an account that's like wisdom from like grandparents, but they're all AI. And it's like, what I wish I knew when I was younger. Like the one thing, you know, the love that got away. And they just post content like that. They're just printing views right now.
Dude, this stuff gets me every time. It sucks. I love this stuff. I fall victim to this worse than like a grandparent falls victim to like buying the top listing on an Amazon. Like every birthday every gift giving experience at my house right now from grandparents, it's like, you guys all just typed in kids bike and bought the exact same thing.
All right. I got to show you one more. This is the best one. All right. So I'm on YouTube the other day, and you know, when the algorithm just like has like a Michelin 5-star, you know, experience for you. So this is one. The most intense shoe salesman you'll ever meet. It's a CBS News archive from 1983.
A shoe store here in Sharon, Pennsylvania is just, you know, a shoe store. Oh, no. That's the playing field of a champion. Here he comes now, out of the bullpen, the hottest pitcher of the retail shoe game today. Big number one, Larry Jolton.
Let me see. Come on up.
All right. So this video, it was of this guy, Larry Jolton, who was the number one shoe salesman in America. And he sold, this is back in 1983, he sold $400,000 worth of shoes at this physical shoe store himself.
Where?
By hand. It's in Pennsylvania. It's some like Rayers or something like that. It's a famous shoe store. And so he was the number one hustler. And this video is amazing because they just
play a clip
him.
On him. I want to see.
The
hook is great. I'm in. I'm bought in.
Right, here you go.
I wouldn't go any bigger than that.
You got some nice dress shoes, 20% off.
Like a light better?
I do too.
Especially in the summertime.
Listen to me.
You order the two shoes, whatever color you want. If it comes in, it don't fit. If you don't like it, you're not obligated to pay.
Big day. Clean it up.
Larry Jolton is the Cy Young of his time. The best of the big league shoe pitchers. There are only 38,000 feet in Sharon, Pennsylvania. Last year, Larry Jolton sold $423,000 worth of shoes.
It's going to be busy today, fellas. I can feel it. It's going to be busy.
His stats make him the MVP, the officially recognized champion shoe salesman.
It's not bad to
love on you. Yeah. All right, so watch this. So they show him doing his thing, and there's a couple of amazing parts. There's all right. So one is he's like the worst thing in the world is someone leaves without a shoe. He's like, that's not going to happen on my watch. So he's serving like four or five customers at once, and he's like, he's basically like selling them on like it's about not about the size, it's about the fit. He's got all these like go-to slogans. And he's like, that's a good looking shoe right there on you. And then he'll like deliver them to their house. He's like, I'll deliver to your house. I'll deliver to your office. I'll find you on the street. I'll give you the shoes. Don't worry. And he's like, if you ever have a problem, you just give right back to me. I'm Larry. And then they show, like, he never takes a lunch break. So they show he's eating a burger.
You have to keep up your strength because sometimes the game goes into extra innings.
He's just eating a burger in the back. He just has a burger in the shoe rack where he finds the sizes. He just takes bites as he's running back and forth to get customers the shoe size.
This guy's awesome.
He's like, and then he's like, you know, he's like his sales philosophy. So he's like, you don't want to be the nice guy. He's like, you know, some people just want to be told. They want to be told what they need. And he's like, you know, they come in, they think their shoe's a size 8.5. They're walking around with cramped feet all the time. He's like, you got to give them a size 10. He's like, he tells the story about this guy, like, didn't know what he wanted. He's like, the customer doesn't always know what they want. You got to help them. And he's like, yeah, that's the art of shoe sales. But just his overall energy. And when he's like walking around the bullpen, like, he's like, gonna be a big day today, boys. Got a lot of shoes we got to move today. And like all the other shoe salesmen, like, clearly don't care. And like, this is a very inspiring video about just like being the best, just be championship mentality in anything you do.
Dude, so he died this year, which is, yeah. He died this year. His obituary, it goes in depth about how he was on that show and a bunch of other shows. And he said he was the National Shoe Retailers Association named him Salesman of the Year in 1983, 84, 85. They say he was a larger than life figure. This guy's awesome.
He's incredible, right? I love this man.
Larry's a salt of the earth type of guy.
If you're going to do anything today, you bring that Larry Jolton energy, that championship mindset to whatever you do. You'd sell whatever you sell the way Larry sold shoes today, all right? That's the final word here.
Have you ever studied sales? Like, I imagine, if I had to guess, you did something, you and I have behaved similarly, which is like, we're pretty charismatic, so we think that's all it takes. But then I've hired salesmen before and saleswomen before, and I've like seen the difference between a really like a winning one and a pretty good one. And it's just like a total, like the greats have both the talent and this thing that I'm gonna describe. But the second thing that they all have to have is process, where like they know that saying this gets that. It's like such a mouse in it finding a cheese type of energy, where it's like the really good ones just kind of blindly, oh, that worked. No ego. I'm just going to do that. Oh, I just threw that thing out there. That caught. That got a laugh doing that one. Like they follow like this process.
Guys like you and me actually suck at sales. And the reason we suck at sales is because we want to use charm, charisma, talent, whatever. And they, you know, the best people use process. And even the reason we actually suck isn't even because we can't adapt that. Because over time, we're like a problem solver. Like it's a puzzle. Oh, I got to do this. And then that gets me the solution I want. We would get bored doing that. The most impressive thing of this guy isn't that he sold $400,000 shoes. It's that he just kept doing it year after year after year. He never got bored of it. I have this phrase I say now because every day when I do my workout, we start with this 10-minute routine where I basically like loosen up my IT band. It's like a fascia release on my IT band, which is painful. It's boring. It doesn't look cool. You don't feel like you're getting any stronger or more athletic. It's like the opposite of what you want when you go into a workout. But I need it. I need it because like I've had knee injuries and I got to keep doing this. And you can't do it once, twice. You can't do it for 2 weeks. You basically have to just constantly do this if you want to stay healthy, if you're got the sort of my leg condition. And now every day when I go in, I say, all right, boys, we're not getting bored of greatness today. Let's not get bored of greatness today, right? The Larry mentality of like, you can't get bored with doing the thing that leads to great results, even if it's the same thing you've done. You can't get bored. You can't become sort of nonchalant about it. You can't become autopilot with it. You can't like cut the corner or cut it short because you already have done it before. Like, you have to do this. And that's when I'm coaching my team. It's the same thing. Like, we played a game the other day and in the warm-ups, I knew we're going to kick this team's butt because their warm-up was so sloppy. I was like, if they warm up like this, they're not going to be able to play at some high level because this tells me everything I need to know. I don't need to do a scouting report. It's over. And sure enough, we beat them by almost like 50 points. And it was, yeah, they didn't have a lot of talent, but they were shortcutting the process. And so, like, I just feel like that, like, getting bored of what gets great results is a real problem. It's been a real problem for me in my life. And I know that, like, for other people, if you're sort of like smart and talented, you get off on solving new problems and new puzzles, it could become an Achilles heel.
Dude, I'm the biggest victim of these stories where it's like a company does the small things right and it like levels up to the big things. So for example, have you heard of Rakuten?
Yeah, I know them well.
So Rakuten's a Japanese company. I think they're like the Amazon of Japan, right? Ish?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's retail, but then there's also like a big like discounting kind of component to it that I think, like deals component to it that I think that Amazon doesn't really have.
Yes, but it's just like a multi-billion dollar, huge, massive thing, whatever.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I came along the founder and I started reading about him, and they have a book because they're famous for having a culty culture. So the culture is like, they're like super into it. And he released a handbook on what their culture and what their values is. It's one of these things where it was supposed to be internal and it was a hit. So now everyone reads it, or a lot of people read it. And like, he has like 30 rules or something of Rakuten. And like rule number one is every Tuesday from 3 to 4, everyone at every office throughout the world, you stop what you're doing and we clean. And we refuse to have cleaners, hired cleaners. And his reasoning was that if we keep our desks clean, it's the same thing. You already know what's gonna, I'm gonna say. Yeah. You keep your desk clean and you have a clean desk, you're gonna have a clean mind. It's gonna keep you disciplined. Same thing, like, you know, general, I forget what the general is who had the famous speech. Make your bed. And then there's all these other famous stories of like a coach of Indiana basketball or something like that who turns around the team and he's like, I started by teaching the front desk how to answer the phone.
Tie the shoelaces. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like these stories over and over and over again. I love all of them. I'm always into these. I don't know how often they are true, but I buy into it. Have you ever tried one of these things with your, I mean, it sounds like you're doing it with your basketball team, warming up, right?
Yeah, we try. I mean, the hard part is to have the courage to actually live by it, right? You could read the story, be like, ah, that's great. And that makes total sense. Then you get into an environment where you got all these people who they're not as bought into it. They don't, you know, they don't really care. And are you going to really force it? And are you really going to enforce it? And how much of a standard really is it? And how many exceptions are you going to create? And are you going to let your best player not do it? Or are you going to let a meeting get in the way of it, right? Like, it's all the compromises is where things get interesting. And I have never gone to the extent where I'm like, truly hardcore about it, because I think it takes like just a different level of leadership and courage that I personally don't possess.
Let me reframe it for you. So in high school, I tweeted this out the other day, but in high school, my freshman year of high school, first practice, I went to an all boys school, first practice for cross country. The coach gets up and he goes, and it was like a Remember the Titans moment. He was like, I'm going to teach you guys something. I'm not here to teach you how to be the best runner. What I'm here to do this year is I'm going to teach all of you boys how to become men. And we're going to do it by learning how to run better. And he goes on to say, like, you know, we're going to like show up earlier than we anticipate. We're going to like run when we don't feel like it. We're going to like go through the pain no matter what. We're going to stick around until the last person's finished because that's what we do with our teammates, you know, the whole thing. And at the time, I kind of like laughed a little bit about it. But then I started buying into it. And it brought us all together. Our team did. And the cross-country team, my high school, SLU, you know, it's a nerdy sport, but we won all the time. We always won. And he used to have this idea of like being great and how you're going to be a great man just via running. And we're going to teach you how to do all these little small things. And it totally worked on our team. And it was awesome. And because of that, this coach has a very cult personality. We used to have this phrase, it was tradition doesn't graduate. That was like, I still remember it. Like tradition never doesn't graduate, you know,
like that.
He was like, he's like, I've been doing this since the 80s. Tradition doesn't graduate. You guys are going to graduate, but we've been doing this the same way and it works. And I just remember all of these like culty lines, and we're talking high school cross country, nothing like significant, but it like meaningfully impacted me and it was awesome. And so this type of like inspire you to be a better human being by teaching you how to work better or clean your desk better. I love that story.
My buddy Jason told me an amazing story like this. So Jason Hitchcock, I think you know Jason. He used to work at Bebo, and I was pretty hard on Jason, or like I would give him feedback all the time. Like, hey, you got to do this. You got to do this. You got to do this. And like, maybe it's because he was one of the non-engineers. So I felt like, you know, there's only a few non-engineers. I'm going to tell you what I think. The engineers, I don't really have as much to say because that's not my domain. And I noticed he took it really well, always, like incredible attitude. So I was doing a one-on-one with him, and I gave him credit for that. I was like, man, I think that you have just like a 10 out of 10 attitude at life and at work. And I just really respect that. And I know that like I give you a bunch of feedback, but you take it so incredibly well, like, you know, whatever. And he was like, I receive it. I go, what? And he goes, I don't take it. I receive it. And he goes, can I tell you a story? Like where that comes from? I said, yeah, sure. He goes, my freshman year, I go to high school. I'm a high schooler and I wanted to play water polo. My brother was the like captain of the water polo team, my older brother. And I thought I was like as good as him or going to be better than him. So I'm feeling myself a little bit. I'm like a hot shot. And he's like, we get in the pool. And I guess like for water polo, like you're basically treading water while you're playing the sport, right? So it's kind of a hard sport. So during the warm up, you're probably not going as hard. So he's being a little sloppy in the warm up where he's treading, but he's like when he's throwing the ball, his like arm is like skimming the it's like in the water still. It's not out of the water like you would want it to be if you were really playing a game. And so the coach, the varsity coach, walks by and he goes, Jason, get your arm out of the water. Keep your arm out of the water. And Jason's like, yeah, yeah, thanks, coach. Keeps going. A couple minutes later, he's like, you know, being a little lazy again, does it again. Jason, keep your arm out of the water. And he's like, yeah, coach, sorry, I will. I'm just getting warmed up. He has something to say back to the coach. Coach blows the whistle. Everybody comes over. He goes, hey, everybody, I'm coach. I just want to introduce you to Jason. Jason is a freshman. Jason is too good for feedback. Jason takes the gift of feedback and he does not care. He doesn't want it. He doesn't want your feedback. All right. And he basically pulled him aside. He like embarrassed him in front of everybody. Like, Jason is too good for feedback. And then he's like, look, Jason, feedback is a gift. If I'm going to give you that gift, you got to receive the gift, right? Don't just throw the gift away when I give you that gift. He goes, think about it, what it takes to give somebody feedback. You have to be kind of vulnerable. You're risking conflict. You have to care about making that person better. These are what it takes to give that gift. And so he was like, feedback is a gift. And so like at the whole company, that became like, you know, a mantra for us, which is like feedback is a gift, which is really important because otherwise you can create a kind of defensive mentality or people shy away from saying something to somebody else. They'll only do it as a last resort. And that's not good. And so the feedback is a gift thing like changed us. And it was a lesson from his high school water polo coach. But the story with the lesson is what we needed for like people to get it.
I love stories like this. They always like get me going. I distinctly remember we did a podcast a year ago where we were talking about, I think I was actually like motivating you. I think like you had said something like, I haven't done anything like world changing, but I've been doing this thing. And I was like, whoa, 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 why are you saying that? Like, who cares? Like, if it's world changing, like, you know, just creating a small game that makes someone just a little bit happier is worth it. Like, you know, like that's not, it's not necessarily less meaningful than anything else. And I sort of have grown to believe that to like work, where high school sports are very insignificant. And yet it's like such a world changing experience for many kids. And I think that we need to take that same energy to work, which is like, you know, we're making a podcast, that's fine. But like, let's even go something way less glamorous. We're making like B2B software. Like, it's not that special, but like you can learn how to be excellent here. You can learn how to follow through here. Like, you can learn how to like say you're going to do what you say and whatever. You can learn how to have this unearned pride where you make these tough decisions when no one is looking. And so I think that like that has carried over to like employees and how I've been working with my team.
That's cool. I like it. Sam's in his leadership arc. That's definitely the season you're in. You gotta start going by like Samuel or something. I feel like we need to upgrade the name, everything. I think you need to reinvent yourself here, actually.
Father. Just Father.
So at work, everyone calls you Father. At home, they call me Sam.
just the same way the stargazing thing exists, there's this thing called universalministries.com where you can sign up and get ordained as a minister. And I've had to do that I've had to do that to like, because I've officiated a couple weddings before, and it's all obviously a crack of bullshit. But I am a minister, so we could go by minister. I am a legal witness. So,
all right, let's take a quick break because I got to tell you a story. Let me tell you about the first time I tried to run payroll for my team. I was using a traditional bank, and you know the type. It's got a janky interface. It's built like a 2002 tax form, and it was open only during business hours. And I hit send. And it froze. They flagged the transaction. They locked my account. They put me on hold for 45 minutes. And then they told me I got to visit my local branch. And that was the day I started looking for a new banking solution. After asking a few founders what they were using, I found out about Mercury. And so now my payroll is two clicks. I can wire money. I can pay invoices. I can reimburse the team all from one clean dashboard. That's why I use it for all of my companies. And so do 200,000 other startup founders. And so if you're looking to level up your banking, head to mercury.com and apply in minutes. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services are provided through Choice Financial Group, Column NA, and Evolve Bank & Trust, members FDIC.
All right, Sean, I want to show you someone who's in the aviation business, in the grocery store business, and actually had a pretty important character in a movie, Marty Supreme, which recently just came out.
Okay, I haven't seen the movie yet.
Okay, well, you know what it is, right? It's like the biggest movie going on right now.
Timothy Chalamet and... Ping pong? I don't really. That's literally the only two words I know.
That's it. Or as Adam Sandler says, Timothy Chalamet. Like he like. Have you seen that? But he does that so good. Okay, so Google John Katmiadondis.
All right, John the Big Cat. Here we go. Who am I looking at? American. Okay, here's just the quick description. American billionaire businessman and radio talk show host. He's the owner, president, chairman, and CEO of grocery chains Gristeeds. I've never heard of that. D'Agostino Supermarkets in Manhattan. Okay, go ahead. $5 billion net worth.
Yeah. Have you never heard of this guy, have you?
No. Is this guy the famous actor? Like, why does this guy look so familiar?
He's a familiar face. He's one of these guys. He's sort of like the character in The Dark Knight who plays the police chief, where like you're like, I've seen this actor everywhere, but what's his name? He sort of has that type of energy. So here's his story. So I think he's 80 now. So he was born, I guess that would mean sometime in the 40s. And he immigrated as a baby from Greece. He came to New York. I believe he moved to Harlem. And then he was an okay student, went to Brooklyn Tech, which in, I think, New York is a pretty good school, but eventually actually got into West Point. So he's clearly smart, but decided not to go to school. And instead, he bought a small grocery store. So at the age of like 20, he convinced a failing grocery store to sell to him at like an owner financing type of setup where he didn't have to come up with a lot of money. But do you know anything about grocery stores? They're like the hardest business to run.
It's like no margin business, right?
Yeah, it's a commodity. There are no margins. So if you look at like the biggest grocery stores, or at least some of the mid-sized grocery stores, like the regional giants, they do like 3% margins. It's incredibly challenging. You have food that's going to spoil. And particularly back in the 70s when he was doing it, you don't have the most like the best systems to like make sure your food's not going to spoil. Very hard. But he's a dog. He's got that immigrant hustle and he's able to grow this business. I think it's something like 7 years. So by the time he's only 32, he has this cool quote that I found in newspapers.com in this old article where he grew the business to the point where he was making something like 40 million a year in revenue, had like 12 or 15 locations. And he goes, I'm now paying myself at the age of, and this actually, he said this at the age of like 28. He was like, I'm paying myself $1 million a year. So through like just hustle and grind, like he kind of makes it work. And he does like a lot of like stuff that we take for granted now, like his grocery stores, they were called Red Apple. They did free cash checking. They did free delivery. It was a discount store, like a lot of stuff that isn't particularly groundbreaking now, but he just like provided like a pretty simple service, but he did it really well. Now Red Apple, which is, I think they have like 100 locations in the city. They own Gristeeds. Have you heard of Gristeeds?
No. Is that like a New York thing?
These are all local things, but here's where it gets weird. So he does two interesting moves. So at the age of 32, I think it is, he was like, well, I was going to get into West Point. My dream was to be a pilot. I've never been able to do that. Gets his pilot license as an activity just for being for fun. And he does this move that I've actually heard Richard Branson do as well. He buys a jet and it's like kind of interesting and kind of fun. But then he's like, I got to turn this into a business. I got to do something. And so he buys one plane, like a relatively small plane. He has a biography and it was just a Cessna, like nothing fancy. And he starts allowing customers to charter his plane from New York City to Atlantic City. And this is like in the 70s and the 80s. So like the airlines are still a little bit nascent, but it's still like pretty complicated, but he pulls it off. And he's able to, so now officially he's in the aviation business. And like one thing leads to another and it grows for like 8 years and eventually becomes like a fleet of like 40 planes and jets, which eventually he sells to Warren Buffett. And that is like one of the beginnings of NetJets, which is one of Berkshire Hathaway's like crown jewels, I believe.
And so he was doing it as private charters, not like an airline like Branson.
No, private charters. But he tried to get into the actual airline business and I don't think it worked out. Now, while all of this is going on, he's still only like 33, 34, 35 years old. He does another crazy thing. He hears about an oil refinery going out of business in Pennsylvania. And the grocery store business, it's a commodity, lots of unions, very low margins, 24-hour, like you have to be working 24 hours to make it work. And somehow, which I never would have thought this would have been a thing, he made the leap that they are comparable and he gets into the oil business and he finds an oil refining company, which do you know what that means?
Not really. They are a middleman in the oil process between drilling for the oil and selling it to the end customer is my guess.
These are all very vague terms. So I had to like figure out like what exactly is oil refining. Basically, if I had to dumb it down, they do two things. One, they have a massive pool or tank in the ground that can store tons and tons and tons of oil. So you drill the oil, it goes to this thing. And it's not particularly useful. You can't use it. And so there's this process where you have to refine it and you could take parts of that
crude oil and turn it into oil that you could use in cars, oil that you can burn as kerosene. You know, oil can turn into multiple products along the way. And that's what he did, was he bought a business that did that, which is actually kind of ridiculous. Like, you never would have thought that that would have been a thing, but it works.
And by the way, when you're reading about this or watching whatever you watched for this, is he just like a gunslinger? Like, why is he going into all these different spaces? He can't help himself. Does he have some aspiration? Is he just, you know, he's just wired that way? Like, what did you get as a sense of, like, the why is this guy doing all why is he bouncing from totally different hard thing to totally different hard thing?
This is why I wanted to bring him up. And so I think you and I will get a kick out of, like, people like him. But let me just add that the last thing he does two things now in his six, I think he's close to 80 now. In his 60s, he does two other wild things. One, he starts an AM radio station, political, like, weekly radio show, which he still is the host of. You can't find it on YouTube and you can't find it on Spotify. You literally only get this on AM radio, and he records every single Sunday. And I've, like, listened to it, and, like, his co-host is this, like, Long Island guy who's like, hey, John, what do you think about this Mom Donnie guy? Like, it's hilarious. Like, he's a very unrefined billionaire, I would say. And I mean that in a cool way. And the second thing, the second thing that he did was he ran for mayor in 2012, I think, and he almost won. And he was like, I'm going to be a mayor for the people in Harlem and the people in Wall Street. So he's this very, like, sort of salt of the earth, immigrant energy type of billionaire guy. But the reason why he's interesting is, A, what's that word that you have been obsessed with? Generative?
Yeah.
He's very generative, but he does this in a way, you know, like the charm that when Donald Trump is being, like, a nice guy, you know, like the charm that he has where he's like, ah, screw it, let's just do it. You know, what's money amongst friends? This, like, old timey, like,
right.
Like, what's a little, like, you know, I'll take a little, you take a little, we all win, like, this type of energy.
Right. My word is my bond. My word is stronger than oak.
This guy is actually that. He has that energy with him, but it's not, he's not hateful at all. So he's a Republican, but he talks very fondly of Obama and Hillary. Like, he's not a hater at all. And he's got this very folksy types of vibe. And when you hear him talk, he's got this thick New York accent, but it's very much a, like, spit on my hand, shake your hand type of energy. And I have found him very fascinating because that, and also now his company, it's called Red Apple Holding Company, I think. They have like 8,000 or 9,000 employees. His family runs it. And I believe him and his kids, they own a building in New York City. They all live in the same building. They run this company together. And he's still, like, incredibly active, even at the age of 80. And he's just constantly doing stuff. He's very interesting to me. And also, he looks very funny. Like,
he was just an actor? He just had a cameo? Was he playing himself? Or he
listen to this. So, Marty Supreme, which is the hottest thing going. I went and saw it the other day.
By the way, how is it? Like, must watch, okay, where are we at?
Did you see Uncut Gems?
Loved Uncut Gems.
Loved. Then you'll like this. So if Uncut Gems is a 9 out of 10 on the stress scale, Marty Supreme is an 8 out of 10. And for people okay. like me, oh, if, you're in my, if you're in my boat, you'll hate it. I hated Uncut Gems, and I hate Marty Supreme.
Too much stress.
Yeah, all the characters are pretty evil, and there's no, like, redeeming qualities of any of them. But he, this guy, John, has, like, a pretty, like, interesting, like, not minor character in Marty right. Supreme. And so I was like, this guy is everywhere. He's a man about town. He's just always doing stuff. And he just seems like sort of in that Jesse Itzler category of people who have fun while winning and doing well. And he's just a really fascinating guy to me.
Dude, I'm reading this guy's Wikipedia and I'm like, wow, that's really amazing. Oh, that's really amazing. And then it's like... He gave a speech at the Stern School of Business expressing his unease about his daughter's graduating class. He said, 480 of the 580 kids are Asian, including Indian. And that's scary when you think about it. We're going to deport most of these kids. So then I was like, oh, well, that may not be so amazing for, you know.
Yeah.
He might kick me right off this podcast.
Did he really say that?
I mean, I don't know. It's on the Wikipedia page.
I didn't see that one, but I did see other things where... I'm like, I couldn't tell if you were trying to be funny and it reads stupid or what.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, he does seem like he's an 80-year-old New Yorker who has a little bit of a big mouth, but my read on him was that he was an all right guy. But maybe I could be wrong.
Assembling this list of what you call capital men, and I feel like he would be one of the capital men where he just takes money, goes into these, you know, sort of mavericks into new spaces, creates new investments, new entities, and whole new industries, and you know, wins more often than not. Doesn't win every time. You actually can't be a capital man if you have a perfect record. It kind of means you did not, you weren't playing as rough as you should have. But wins more often than not. I feel like this guy's in that bucket.
Yeah, I was reading his book, and there seems like a common theme. A lot of these guys, there's one point in their life where they're just, what was the phrase we used? They're leveraged up to the tits. Like, they're just like, they have crazy amounts of debt.
What's the scientific term?
Derek from More Plates, More Dates, he always says, this guy's juiced to the gills. Yeah. And when I was reading about old Johnny Katz, I was like, this guy's leveraged to the tits. He's leveraged to the gills. And so, yeah, you have to pay the price to do a lot of this stuff. But I love these young guys who are like, have this gunslinging energy.
So he is your Billy of the Week?
Yeah. So the whole anti-Indian thing, I didn't know about that when I got into this. So this is
sorry to throw you.
So I should have done a little capital J journalism. Otherwise, I was going to say we should have invited him onto the pod. But I think that probably won't be happening.
Hey, we can still invite him. Let's see what happens.
You should ask him about that quote.
We'll just make sure we do it remote. I don't disclose my location.
I didn't realize he said that. So did he say, what other dumb stuff did he say? He said a few
something
dumb things.
There's something about Hitler. Yeah, I don't know.
Man, classic blunder.
He compared raising taxes on the wealthy to how Hitler punished the Jews, which is...
Yeah, that's probably not the best place to go to.
A trap we've all fallen into.
Yeah, I did read that line and I was like, ugh, dude. Like, we have seen time and time again that type of comparison. Just people have tried to make it. Literally not once has it ever worked.
Dude, I might end up being the richest man in California. Have you heard about this billionaire tax?
Yeah, so is the gist of it that net worths will be taxed at 5%?
Yes. One-time tax of 5% for billionaires. So all the billionaires are leaving, which will mean they'll just be like, okay, we'll move to the next class of people. Soon enough, I'll be the last man standing in California.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty stupid law. But at the same time, I'm like, isn't it crazy how little power a billionaire has if they have to leave their home?
If Ro Khanna can bully you.
Yeah, like, do you really have that much power? It's like another Dark Knight reference. Have you seen when Bane is talking to the guy doing construction and the little guy's like, I'm in control, and Bane puts his hand on his shoulder, he goes, do you feel in control? Because like Bane is about to like snap his neck. That's sort of like
that's the 850,000 votes it takes to put this on the bill.
That's sort of the energy that I'm feeling right now, which is like these billionaires being like, you know, we're the big shots. It's like, you don't look like the big shot. If you have to flee your home. That said, it is kind of a stupid rule because so like the analogy that I always use is, let's say that you buy a Picasso painting for $5 at a garage sale. And turns out you didn't realize it, but you bought like, you know, a one of one rare piece of art. Now your net worth is hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever the painting is worth. How are you supposed to pay taxes on that assessed value?
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, you don't even have to go as far as the finding a Picasso at a garage sale example, which is, you know, that's more of an edge case. But like, you're a founder of a startup in San Francisco. You're on paper net worth is $200 million, but that's just because you have an AI company that was hot and you raised a round. That doesn't mean you have that money. That doesn't mean that money is anywhere close to guaranteed for you, but you would be on the hook for the taxes the following year, which is pretty wild. I mean, all it'll do is just obviously going to drive the wealthiest people out, obviously drive the startup founders who want to get wealthy out, because why would you start here? And literally like, strangled the golden goose of California. It's like, oh yeah, what did you achieve? What did you accomplish with that?
I read that it said like 20 or 30 families have left, like prominent families. You should make a public announcement.
Oh, I'm leaving.
Like the 31st. Yeah.
Oh, what a great idea. That's hilarious. That's like that one time that I tweeted that I was buying Bitcoin and then it somehow got picked up by all the Bitcoin like magazines and newspapers, and they were like, executive Sean Puri says he's moving 20% of his net worth into Bitcoin. And I'm like, I don't think y'all know how small that net worth is. You know, like that's not magazine worthy. this has escalated far too quickly for me.
I saw some guy online announce that he was leaving and everyone was making fun of him. And they're like, you know, you're not important enough to like for us to care.
Yeah. You own two duplexes. you didn't qualify for the bill. All right.
Is that what it is, by the way? A billion?
Well, there was a proposal for 50 million. That didn't make it. Then they went to the billionaire tax because it's like, who's going to not vote for that? And so that's the one that's currently proposed. But people have done the math. Like, even if you tax the billionaires, even if you took all the billionaires' money, it doesn't like plug the hole of the California spending. It's like, basically, it's setting precedent for, it's kind of like income tax, right? Income tax, I think, was supposed to be this one time. What was the first one? Like 3%? It's like, it's a one time only 3% tax on income. Like, don't worry, guys. It's okay. And now, like, everybody pays income tax, you know, 20, 30, 40%, 50% of your income every year now. And so the idea would be once they set the precedent that they could just tax you on your property that you have not realized any gains on, then that's a problem. And if they can set the bar at a billion, then they could easily change it or add, well, also if you're over 100 million, then you pay this. And also if you're over 40 million, you're going to pay this. And, you know, they could sort of just continue on from there.
I've always found it interesting how people come up with round numbers to make as the threshold. Like, so if I remember correctly, like, I think, like in the 1910 or 1920s, this idea of a millionaire kind of came to be where like people were using the phrase millionaire, like you're a millionaire, you've made it. And it's kind of funny that 100 years later, we still use that as like a threshold, right? Because a millionaire in 1920 would be something like 20 million today. I think it was 18 or 20X or something like that. And then billionaire, like people are like, billionaire shouldn't exist. And I'm like, okay, but why 1 billion? Why not 800 million? It just, I've always found that to be interesting how we like have settled on this perfectly round number.
Dude, so yesterday I took my whole basketball team, like the team I'm coaching, to the Warriors game. And I like wanted to make like a special thing. So like after they won their last game in the locker room, you know, normally we're just sort of like saying like, you know, you did this well, you did this poorly. And then I was like, want to do something for you guys. It's your birthday coming up. You guys want to go to a Warriors game? And then we went as a group and they got to go courtside and see Steph Curry. Like, it was cool.
And you just ruined all of their eligibility for going to NCAA by providing.
I accidentally violated like HIPAA.
Wait, how did you get courtside? You just knew a guy who knew a guy?
I don't know if he wants me to say, so I won't say his name, but yeah, no guy who's with the team, ex-player. And so he was like, he just literally like waved his hand. He's like, I'll let them come down. And the security guard's like, I guess if he's waving his hand, you can go. And I was like, yeah, me and these other 18 guys. And so we all went, but anyways, it's part of a story of taking, I had one extra ticket. So I took my son who's 4.5 years old and, you know, taking a kid to a game like this, like his first basketball game, you know, we have to leave after the, you know, second quarter because it's like bedtime and I got to drive him back home. But on the drive back, so I'm hoping I'm going to have this amazing father-son time bonding. And like, I'm like wanting him to love him. Like, watch, that's the greatest shooter ever, Steph Curry. Like, that's the closest we've ever been to God right here, this 5 feet away. And he's like trying to care, but he doesn't really care. He's like, can we get his candy now? And I'm like, okay. I got him some M&Ms. And I'm like, every time the Warriors make a shot, you get an M&M. Now he's like locked into the game. And so then finally we leave. And of course, the drive home was this like amazing moment. I put Tesla in like self-driving. And I just talked to my son for like an hour. And it was like a one-on-one because I have three kids. So normally it's not one-on-one, but I got to talk to him. So he told me, he goes, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I want to be a builder. And I was like, amazing. Builder of like what? And he's like, do I have to pick? And I was like, no, I guess not. And so I'm telling him about builders. Like that, somebody built this bridge. Somebody built this building. Somebody built this car. And somehow I start explaining to him who Elon Musk is. And I'm basically doing a podcast episode for him. And I'm like, you know, rockets? This guy builds rockets that land themselves. And he's like, what did they do before they landed themselves? And I was like, honestly, I don't know. Maybe that's actually hype because like people went to the moon and came back. So I don't know. They like, you know, they come back. They do come back. Anyways, don't ask too many questions. So I'm telling him about Tesla. And he's like, did he start it? And I'm like, no, not technically, but let's not get into those details. So I'm telling him about Elon Musk and I tell him he's the richest man in the world. He's got, you know, money. He's got the most money in the whole world. And he's like, how much money does he have? And I was like, he's got like $300 billion, $400 billion, something like that. He goes, he's like quiet for like 30 seconds. And then I'm like, did you hear how much money he had? Like, I'm trying to, like, are you still there? Did you fall asleep? What happened? And he goes, can it even fit in his wallet? And I was like, no. He goes, so he has to use a grocery cart? And I was like, no. And I'm like, explaining the concept of banks. And so anyways, I had this long conversation with him about money and about, like, you know, these, like, the sort of the builders and the prolific people that sort of make all this happen. And it just reminded me, like, I don't know.
By the way, did your son have a take on the simulation?
We didn't get there. That'll be the next time. He does have a lot of questions similar to that. Like, you know, like, where did the earth come from? And then I'm like, yo, honestly, like, we're very much past the edge of my understanding of, like, I don't know, to be honest. And, like, who's older, the earth, the sun? There's a lot of questions that are pretty tough. But the good thing is, in the car, they have, like, AI built in. So you just, like, if I don't know, we just turn on AI and ask AI, and then AI tells us. Anyways, so that's that.
All right, that's the pod.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back.
All right, my friends, I have a new podcast for you guys to check out. It's called Content is Profit, and it's hosted by Luis and Fonzie Cameo. After years of building content teams and frameworks for companies like Red Bull and Orange Theory Fitness, Luis and Fonzie are on a mission to bridge the gap between content and revenue. In each episode, you're going to hear from top entrepreneurs and creators, and you're going to hear them share their secrets and strategies to turn their content into profit. So you can check out Content is Profit wherever you get your podcasts.